This podcast is brought to you by AJ Bell and Shares Magazine. Shares Magazine is published by AJ Bell Media, part of AJ Bell.
Hi, welcome to the latest edition of the AJ Bell Money Markets podcast. My name is Dan Coatsworth and I'm joined this week by Danny Hewson. Hi there, Danny.
Hi, Dan. Hello, everyone. Nice to see you again.
Now, if you're hoping for some Mickey Mouse content with golden nuggets about spluttering vehicles, you've come to the right place. Disney is the big story of the week for investors as activist investor Nelson Peltz has been defeated in his attempts to get a seat on the board of directors. We'll be chatting about the implications of this news in just a sec.
Gold has hit another record high, so we dive into the reasons why the precious metal is doing so well. We'll also take a look at some disappointing news from Tesla and what it means for the electric vehicle space.
Tom Seaver from Shares Magazine will be joining us on the podcast this week to talk about the state of the UK stock market. And there's been a warning from one of the big brokers that we could see hundreds more companies disappear from the London Stock Exchange over the coming years.
Jeremy Hunt promised us a new British savings bond when he gave us his budget last month, and we've now got all the juicy details.
There's also some news about the rise of billionaires. So, Danny, I'm hoping you've got some tips on how we can join that club. First up, shall we look at what's been happening on the markets? I think Disney is the big story. I think we should start with that one.
Disney is the big story. You're absolutely right. It's been everywhere.
What do you think? Should we start from the beginning? What's a 60-second sales pitch on Disney? What's been happening there?
60-second sales pitch is that there was an attempted boardroom coup. So activist investor Nelson Peltz, he was sort of involved in a fight with Wendy's and Procter & Gamble, the Pampers makers. Well, he has been deeply unhappy with how Disney has been performing. And I think it's fair to say that he has certainly a number of reasons to be unhappy with Disney's performance. And I know we'll talk a bit more about that. But he was trying to get a couple of seats on the board to make some sweeping changes. So he has been lobbying investors. And last night, we got the results of the vote. And I took a listen to the start of the meeting when Nelson Peltz actually gave a few minutes. He was told he had 2 minutes, but unsurprisingly, he went over his allotted time. And he just sounded like a man who knew that he had already lost the argument. And he came away with just over 30% of the vote, which means that the board remain in place as is. But of course, there are still huge questions about what next for Disney, particularly because Bob Iger, you know, I mean, he's due to retire. His retirement has been pushed and pushed and pushed. Now we're told 2026, but who will take over? Because the last time he put someone in place, it didn't go so well. And Mr. Iger had to come back in less than a year after he'd retired. I mean, it was a mess, Dan.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's probably a few things to unpick there. So let's start with the sort of the CEO succession. So what I find it hard is that surely if you're you're a bright 40, 50 year old, you've got some decent experience on your CV, surely somewhere in the world there must be someone who can come in and, you know, bring some fresh thinking to Disney. What on earth are they doing? Why is it taking so long to find someone new? Because we know that Bob Iger is essentially a caretaker boss. He's there to steady the ship. But, you know, it's just very strange. So this is one of the things that Nelson Peltz was saying. You know, he wanted to sort of get someone in. He always said, oh, my style as an activist investor is not to get a seat on the board and then immediately fire the CEO. So I think it was more of a case of if he got that seat, he would say, this is what I'm seeing. You know, this is what we should be thinking about, sort of a slowly, softly approach. So I guess the fact that he's been quite vocal about this, it doesn't really matter. They didn't get a seat because everyone already knows his argument, don't they? So, So I don't know the answer. Why have they not found anyone? I mean, have you heard anything?
Because Bob Chapek, when he came in, you know, he picked a number of fights with the wrong people, particularly Ron DeSantis, the Florida governor. I mean, that became incredibly nasty and incredibly damaging for Disney, which, of course, is why Bob Iger had to come back in. I mean, I suppose you can look at the timing. We had the pandemic, which really did impact the ability for Disney to make money, because one of the huge money makers is its parks, its tourist attraction. You know, Disneyland, incredible place to visit, but people weren't able to go. So people, Disney was having to rely on not even films in the cinema. It was having to rely on its streaming services. And we know that streaming services have been a battleground which has seen a number of casualties. Netflix has had to pull itself up by its bootstraps. Disney is having to do the same. And I think when you look at the share price since the start of the year, investors certainly feel that that is happening. And I think that's the reason that this vote didn't get any more people heading Nelson Peltz's way. Disney has really sort of doubled down on, instead of creating lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of content, much of it not really great, it's now creating less content, fewer movies and series, but with far greater impact, bringing back the magic. I mean, that was the whole point of what the board was saying it wanted to do, bring back the magic, because the House of the Mouse has lost a bit of sparkle, Dan.
I know. I actually think that there should be, they should make an agreement, no more superhero films for at least another 2 years. I think everyone's sick of it. So they've milked that as much as they can, the sort of the Marvel universe. They've been remaking these old classic cartoons as live action films, and it's very hit or miss. And of course, this is another thing that Nelson Peltz has been saying, like, you know, yeah, you've been messing up, sort of thing. Why go back to something really interesting? You've got great stories here. And of course, Disney's got lots of great intellectual property. So this is the idea that it's got brilliant characters, whether they're cartoons or the films. It can do lots with them, bring them back into TV series and make merchandise. Of course, if you go to theme park, you can see people dressed up as these characters. And everyone loves to sort of, you're living in, they've been brought to life. And, you know, everyone loves that. So in a way, you can see why so much interest about Disney. And lots of people, you know, have sort of see these characters. These are evergreen characters. Generation after generation will be able to love them. So really, it shouldn't be hard to fix Disney. It's just some absolute common sense. You know, I don't want to see any more superheroes fighting. It's all computer generated battles. It's so boring. Can we just have a conversation?
But I think there is some politics at play here as well, because I know that the sort of label of woke has been leveled at Disney, and there's been a lot of people taking pot shots of some of the decisions that have been made. Whether or not you agree with all of those decisions, whether or not you agree with some of the content it's created, I think we need to take the politics out of, you know, Disney. And that is incredibly hard, particularly when we're in the run-up to, you know, a change of president potentially.
Yeah, so I think what you made the comment about that the share price has been picking up, and perhaps that's why investors didn't see the need for sort of Nelson Peltz to join the board. So I guess the question next is, what does he do now? He still owns a chunk of the company. The statement that he put out after losing this was very, not what you expect. I was reading an FT article the other day, and they sort of suggested that people call him a bully billionaire. And he said, okay, fair enough. But this was very sort of gentlemanly, like saying, I wish you all the best. Thank you for your support. And of course, I thought, so I wonder, I presume he'll be quiet for a little bit. Let's see if Bob Iger can produce the results that he's sort of been promising at. Because if you go back to the results from February, earnings are growing, shareholders are getting a much bigger dividend, they're investing in the theme parks, they're promising to do better things with the quality of the films, streaming businesses, all the combined streaming businesses, are on track to be profitable this year. I guess Nelson Peltz was talking about Disney Plus was still losing lots of money. So I think obviously that if you separated that from the rest of streaming businesses, that might still got work to do. So I think shareholders definitely happy at the moment, but maybe give it 6-12 months. And if Disney doesn't look like it's properly fixed, that's the point at which Nelson Peltz might sort of step up his game again and get angry. But you know, for the time being, I'm sure he'd be quiet, but he'll be watching everything like a hawk, won't he?
It will. But I think they've got quite an interesting slate of films. And of course, the big one for the summer is the Moana follow-up. And my kids probably not that interested in going anymore. So I might have to be one of those sad people that goes and sits in the back of the cinema without taking kids along with them, because I absolutely loved the first film. And you're right, it is about those stories, the characters that get people to go into the cinema, to buy the outfits, to visit the theme parks. You know, that is where Disney excels. And if it can get that right, investors will be happy.
Yeah.
Gold. Let's talk about gold. Disney is looking for gold, and it's been moving higher again.
Yeah, hit another all-time high, $2,288 an ounce. This is really interesting because if you look at the stock market's doing quite well, risk appetite is back. On sort of face value, you think, well, why is gold doing well? Normally, if the stock market was falling, people would be piling into gold because perhaps they're worried about stuff. But this, they're moving in tandem, which is very unusual. And I think it's partly because central banks have been buying more gold. There's also the continuing backdrop of geopolitical risks. You've got tensions in the Middle East. Ukraine and Russia are still at war with each other. So I just think that you've got this sort of, whilst the broad equity markets are doing okay, there's still a sense of nervousness for some people. So they've been buying this here. You've got federal policymakers this week have said that it would be reasonable to cut interest rates 3 times in the US this year, even if we've got strong economic data. So I think that you've got gold offers no yield to investors and tends to benefit from a fall in interest rates. So there's chatter that people are buying gold to protect themselves against the risk of further rise of inflation. So I think, in this situation, normally people would look at gold mining shares as one way to play stronger gold price. Yeah, there's certainly been periods where a rising gold price, actually, miners have outperformed that. Obviously, the higher the gold price, lots of projects now become more economical to do. Of course, bigger profit margins. But here, this is not quite worked. I looked at some of the numbers for some of the sort of the bigger names in the industry. On the UK market, you've got Centamin has done very well, up 13% year to date. But Endeavour Mining is down 8%. And if you look at the big players in the US, Newmont Mining, Barrick Gold, both of those are down. And this is quite interesting. So they're not following the usual pattern of gold mining shares will outperform a rising gold price. I think here you've got industry costs have gone up a lot recently. And I wonder whether people are just getting a bit fatigued about some of these big names sort of saying, we're going to do more big deals and stuff. It's like, well, can't you just focus on what you've got and, try and improve your profit margins? And also, I think lots of people just realize that they can buy a tracker fund that tracks the price of physical gold. It's just an easier way to do it without the hassle of investing in a company that perhaps is operating in riskier parts of the world and very uncertain outlook. So overall, yeah, gold's an interesting one, but equally, every time you hear these stories about gold hitting a record high, there's lots of people coming in and saying, oh, this has gone too far. The only way for it is to head is down. None of us know where it's going to go next, but it's not a sort of a low risk place for you to park your money.
Forget gold, Dan. Did your kids get chocolate coins for Easter? That is the question.
well, they didn't actually know, but I was looking, there's some stuff about the cost of chocolates going up, isn't it? So what, Crazy. Are you a big fan of the cocoa price?
It caught my eye because there's been a rally recently because of issues in Ghana. So supply and demand, obviously it's been Easter. We've all been thinking about the price of chocolate. All those supermarkets have done some great deals. Cocoa's price has absolutely rocketed over the last couple of weeks. In fact, there was a huge rally at the end of March, which sent prices up towards the $10,000 mark, which seemed unthinkable just a few months ago. And it made it more expensive than bellwether industrial metal copper. So if you've got copper pennies, forget it. You know, the Royal Mint might want to take a look at chocolate coins, not just for kids.
Well, yeah, so time to have a look down the back of the sofa, if you see if you've got any chocolate coins left over from Christmas. So, so I think we've been talking about bling. Should we talk about Brom now? Hopefully,
nice.
You'll hopefully heard this, the fantastic interview we had on last week's podcast with Ewan Markson Brown from Crux Asset Management. He was talking about the long-term outlook for electric vehicles. But actually, anyone reading the news over the last few days might have got a sort of a different takeaway, because the headlines have been fairly bleak. So particularly with what's going on with Tesla. So Danny, what's been going on there?
Yeah, I'm going to start with some figures which came out today from the Society of Motor Manufacturers and Traders, which of course looks at car sales in the UK. And it found that there has been another decline in the market share for EVs. So just 15% of new cars registered in March were pure electric. That is down from over 16% in the same month last year. Now, this is really important because we've got this zero emissions vehicle mandate, which says that 22% of new cars sold this year must be zero emission, which in most cases means pure electric, rising to 100% by 2035. But of course, you know, we are still in a situation where a lot of people are still in a cost of living crisis. The thought of spending money on an EV is just too much. And of course, there are still concerns about infrastructure, range anxiety, and the lack of government intervention to try and tempt us to buy these kind of clean green vehicles. So the SMMT is urging the government to halve VAT on electric vehicles or stop the plans to introduce excise duty on EVs. But it's not just a UK issue. It is a global issue. And we can see that, as you say, by the fact that we had an update from Tesla, and it delivered the fewest number of EVs in the last quarter since 2022, just 387,000 in the 3 months. Now, that's down significantly, a 9% fall in sales. And that's despite the fact that we've seen them take a red pen to the sticker price of cars to try and get more people to buy EVs. And it's not just Tesla as well. I was looking at BYD, which, of course, is the Chinese EV manufacturer, which overtook Tesla to take the crown of the world's biggest EV manufacturer, biggest EV seller. It actually saw sales of just 300,000 in those 3 months. So Tesla actually managed to take back its crown. But also at the same time, we're hearing from Renault's boss, Fabrice Cambolive, who was talking about the fact that they're ending production of their best-selling Zoe EV and saying that going forward, plans about EVs, pure electric vehicles, would depend on the market, saying for them, hybrid technology was the thing. And we've seen similar moves from a whole load of legacy automakers, VW, Audi, Ford, Mercedes-Benz, all of them either changing their EV construction delivery targets or completely altering their plans altogether. And Apple has also pulled the plug on its e-car project. I think when you think about the implications for global warming, making that switch to EVs just seems like a no-brainer. But for most people, actually, when you're trying to think about the implications on your life of having an EV. We couldn't have an EV here because we don't have anywhere to charge it. And unless you're prepared to, you know, go down to the local supermarket and plug in there and spend an hour or so, and the cost is still prohibitive. And it's been a really fascinating period of time because people have been thinking more about their own budgets than they have for years and years. We just don't have that same kind of disposable income at hand. So when people are thinking of making the switch, they're putting off that decision-making at the moment.
It's interesting because we just had some figures out as we're recording this podcast from Motorpoint, which is a UK sort of nearly new car seller. And he actually said, this year, it's seeing a pickup in demand after having a pretty terrible time last year. So, but I guess if you're spending money on a sort of a, say, a three or four year old car versus the cost of an electric vehicle, a new one, there's still this big gap, isn't there? And I think that's the thing. Tesla, BYD cutting prices, but perhaps they need to come down a lot more to really make this sort of mass market appeal. So it's time to bring on Tom Siever from Shares Magazine to talk about a stark warning from one of the city's main brokers about the state of the UK stock market. Now, we're seeing lots of companies being taken over or shifting their listing to the US. So in effect, that means the UK market is shrinking. Now, Peel Hunt has issued a punchy statement on the outlook for the UK. So Tom, what has it said?
Yeah, thank you, Dan. So this is a drum Peel Hunt has been banging for some time. They talk about de-equitization, but yeah, in more simple terms, it's exactly what you just said. It's companies being bought or delisting from London and also a lack of new companies floating on the market as well. So you're not kind of, you've got companies leaving and not being replaced. And their latest research in this area saw them warn that the FTSE Small Cap Index, which is slightly more obscure, obviously, than the FTSE 250 and the FTSE 100, wouldn't exist by 2028, based on the current rate of companies that are exiting. And while it's more obscure, that's important because, you know, in a way, this represents the pool of companies that could become the next FTSE 250 or FTSE 100 companies over time. So, it is, as you say, quite a sort of stark warning. They haven't been afraid recently of really sort of banging this drum, as I said.
And it's clearly bad news for the UK market and the UK more generally.
Yeah, absolutely. So as the sort of depth and breadth of the market is undermined, it becomes a bit of a vicious circle because it then becomes a less attractive listing venue, becomes harder to attract capital, and therefore you see a continuing exodus of companies. And if you're thinking about the UK economy as a whole, it's the small and medium-sized companies which are the ones that are growing, and they're the ones that are sort of adding new jobs. And they're the ones that are typically being taken over, or they're finding they can't get capital from the markets to invest in their businesses. Whereas the really big beasts are often kind of shrinking their workforces. So yeah, there is definitely a wider sort of knock-on effect on the UK economy.
So why is it happening? What is it about now?
Yeah, thanks, Daddy. So the reasons why it's happening include the fact that the market has generally been struggling to attract capital from domestic sources and particularly overseas since the Brexit vote in 2016. Peel Hunt observes that we've seen outflows from UK funds for the last 34 months consecutively. And the kind of net result of that is that larger UK companies look very undervalued relative to their global counterparts. And that makes them appealing to foreign buyers. And when you go sort of further down the food chain, some small cap companies are struggling to make ends meet because they can't attract capital, or they're feeling unable to justify the costs and hassle of being a public company. And finally, you know, as Dan touched on at the beginning, you've also got businesses moving their primary listings elsewhere to see if they can benefit from the higher valuations afforded stocks, particularly, you know, in areas like the US market.
So what, I mean, I guess what the key question is, what could be done to actually revive the UK market, make it more attractive?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Peel Hunt is surprisingly optimistic. You know, it says this isn't a sort of fait accompli. Like there are things that can be done to fix the situation. So they outline a number of areas. They said if you could increase the appetite of retail investors to put their money into UK stocks through a British ISA or changes to things like dividend tax or capital gains tax on UK shares, or by reducing what they describe as the penal level of stamp duty versus other markets that you see in the UK. They also talk about pension funds allotting more of their funds to UK stocks and UK stocks increasing share buybacks. I mean, I would say that the likelihood is that the British ISA wouldn't make a huge difference. We featured an article from a regular contributor to the podcast, Laith Califf, in the magazine not that long ago. And he was talking about that even if you made the assumption that all of the people, so about a million people who max out their 20,000 ISA allocation, put £5,000, you know, use the extra allocation in the BRISA or British ISA, that would be an extra £5 billion going into UK stocks each year. And while that might sound like quite a lot of money, the value of the FTSE All Share as a whole is £2.3 trillion. So it's not going to make much of a difference, I don't think. What might make a bigger difference is if pensions were encouraged to invest more in UK stocks, because there's a lot more capital involved there. But that obviously would come with its own risks, and there would be questions about whether that's in the best interests of the people the money is being invested on behalf of. So there are possible solutions, but there aren't kind of straightforward ones, I suppose.
I think at the tail end of last year, there was lots of chatter about there was this big pipeline of companies who actually were preparing to list in the UK. We've not really seen much activity yet. But, I mean, the stock market's been doing all right for the last 6 months. And I it just feels like confidence is returning. Risk appetite is improving. I wonder, yeah, you know, if we had some companies with an interesting story, you'd certainly get an appetite for people. They're looking for new ideas. Investors are always looking for new ideas. And yeah, I think that actually, you know, if there were some companies and they were decent, I think perhaps ones that were profitable, not the sort of the blue sky story, the jam tomorrow story sort of thing, but, you know, just a nice little decent business making money now, I actually think that they would do okay. It's quite interesting that, you know, someone like Peel Hunt, obviously it would love to see lots more companies list, because that's part of its job, is to try and raise money for these companies. So maybe what we need is, you know, interest rates to fall, a little bit more confidence amongst investors, and actually, I think maybe just the natural flow of things will just see things come on. But I know lots of people talking about that everyone's shifting their listings to the US, but actually, if you look at the numbers, it's not that big. It's just like they're just big headlines, but they really are. You could count it on two hands the amount of companies that have moved from the UK to the US. From people you talk to, for when you're putting together Shares Magazine, Tom, I mean, what do you get a sense that actually, you know, it's not that bad, that situation? The UK market still has lots of opportunities, and investors still are finding things to put their money into.
Yeah, you could go overboard on the doom and gloom, definitely. And you're right to say that there's an element of self-interest in this for Peel Hunt. And I think, you know, you've also seen what I think the UK market shouldn't do is sort of water down its listings rules in order to try and attract companies. Because if you attract a load of poor quality companies, that's going to do nothing for the market's reputation or for the health of the market, really. So I think you're right. And I think almost just a period of more, you know, a period of stability for the UK and a kind of improved financial outlook. And as you say, a kind of a pivot towards rate cuts, that those are all elements that could on their own sort of improve investor sentiment, start to build a bit of a, you know, a better environment for UK stocks. So I think you're right to say that. And yes, there are, you know, I think there are genuine concerns amongst small cap companies that they are really struggling to attract capital. But there are still some really great businesses in the UK and on the UK market. And you can lose sight of that when you're having this sort of wider discussion about, you know, the difficulties that the UK market is facing.
And it's difficult because I think a lot of investors are blinded by the headlines, particularly those huge rock stars like the Magnificent Seven or the Fab Four, however you want to look at them. And the fact that the UK doesn't have any of those kind of names, is that a help or a hindrance?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. You know, it's certainly an area where the UK market is underrepresented is technology. And that's, you know, perhaps been to the market's detriment. But, you know, there are other important sort of sectors that you shouldn't lose sight of, even, you know, if technology is very in fashion and very popular at the moment. So there are some excellent businesses, particularly in sort of areas like, you know, in the industrial sector in kind of engineering, that are based in the UK and that are listed on the UK market. So, yes, I think Dan's right to say that, you know, it's not all doom and gloom. And I think, hopefully, at least, there will be a sort of natural improvement just as kind of economic conditions change and interest rates come down and you start to see some decent quality businesses listing in the UK again.
So, Dan, a month ago, Jeremy Hunt teased us with the news of a new British savings bond. We've now got all the details, so fill us in.
Well, it's quite disappointing, to be honest. You know, it was sort of hyped up in the budget, thinking, OK, this is brilliant. We're going to have something that pays really well. But it's only going to pay 4.15% interest. And that's below the best three-year bond that you can find in the market, which pays 4.63% at the time of recording. So I think National Saving Investment, NSNI, said it kind of wants to price the bonds so they'll be sticking around. So rather than, you know, what we've seen before when everyone rushes into them because they've got such a good rate and then they kind of sell out, price it a little bit less. So I think it's a tricky one here. They don't want to have too high a rate because then it will attract swathes of cash and they'll pull these accounts from sale. But if they don't want to price it too low because savers will clearly go somewhere else. So I'm sure there'll be a market for it. Because government-backed savings is seen as sort of the safest place to keep your money. Because if you park your money with a bank or building society, they're protected by the Financial Services Compensation Scheme. So that covers you up to £85,000 of money per person per financial institution. So theoretically, that means your money is safe with a bank. It's safe as it is with National Savings and Investments, but with National Savings Investments, you can essentially put a much bigger amount of money in there and get your money protected by the government. And I think that for a lot of people, that's very important. But here, this new savings bond, you can't withdraw your money early. So previous versions of these bonds, NSNI allowed people to exit bonds early if they sacrificed some interest, but that's not allowed now. So your money is tied up for full 3 years here. You can invest up to £1 million. So actually a few years ago, NSNI restricted people to a maximum investment of £10,000 in their guaranteed bonds. But you know, this new British savings bond, £1 million, minimum investment is £500. And you can pick whether you want the interest now or later. So if you pick the income bond version, you'll get the interest paid each month into your bank account. So that means you can spend it. So I guess this is a good option if you need the income each month to live off. So retired people might be interested in that. But if you don't need the income, there's a growth option, which means interest is rolled up and added to the bond each year. So if you think NSNI is very popular for selling premium bonds, those are tax-free, but these bonds now, the new one, they're not tax-free. So it means that you could pay tax on the interest that you earn. Now, we've all got personal savings allowance, which gives people a tax-free limit for interest that they earn on savings before the tax. And it currently stands at £1,000 for basic rate taxpayers, £500 for high rate taxpayers. Additional rate taxpayers get no tax-free allowance. So once you breach that limit, you'll pay tax on the interest at your income tax rate. So if you're likely to face a tax bill for the interest, you might want to weigh up whether an ISA would be a better place for your cash savings.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. My parents were mad devotees of the premium bond, and we always used to get excited, but they never won very much.
No. I still have some premium bonds, which I was given as a child. And yeah, they're doing nothing. Quite frustrating. So before we go, Danny, I just want to ask you about Forbes data on billionaires that's been doing the rounds this week. So the headline's all about Taylor Swift being a billionaire. And I guess if you're a parent, you shouldn't be surprised about that, particularly if you've had to fork out tickets to her forthcoming UK tour. And I'm certainly one of them. What else did this announcement say? And I think most importantly, how can I become a billionaire?
Well, I always hoped that premium bonds would be the thing to do it, but they never quite managed. You're right, Swifty. The fact that the Eros Tour actually made an impact upon United States GDP, I think, says all you need to know about Taylor Swift and her supreme popularity. And yeah, I think when you're talking about someone like that giving so much enjoyment to people like your kids, it seems only fair that she is making money out of it. So I don't think anyone's going to balk at the fact that she's made this Forbes billionaires list for the first time. Also making the list for the first time, chatbot creator Sam Altman, which was an interesting addition. Topping the list, unsurprisingly, Bernard Arnault, who, of course, is behind the LVMH luxury goods maker. Forbes said 2,781 billionaires for 2024, up 141 more than last year, although 26 fewer than the previous record, which was in 2021. And something which really got my goat is that this class of billionaires are 255% richer than a decade ago, which, you know, certainly when we have been talking about people seeing their living standards eroded, it was one of the things which sort of made people wince a little bit, that the richest members of society seem to be getting richer. Though there were a number of billionaires who dropped off the list. And of course, as always, a few that passed away. But yeah, it's fascinating when you get these lists, you sort of pore over them and sort of imagine what that number of zeros in your bank account would look like.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess for most of us, we can only dream. So we've only got time for that this week. So love to get your suggestions before we go on the type of guests that you'd like to hear on the podcast. Quite interested to know if anyone would like to hear interviews with company bosses. Do you want some more fund managers on the show? Do you want some more personal finance experts? Email any ideas to podcast@ajbell.co.uk. Then we've got Rachel Vay on the show next week to answer your pension questions. So please make sure you tune in next time. Until then, thank you very much for listening.
Before you go, please remember this podcast is for educational purposes, and the views expressed don't necessarily reflect those of AJ Bell or Shares Magazine. The podcast isn't telling you if a certain investment is suitable or not. Don't forget that the value of investments can change and you can lose money as well as make it. It's also important to remember that how you're taxed will depend on your individual circumstances and rules can change. The way an investment performed in the past may not be the same as how it behaves in the future. If you want help, go see a qualified financial advisor.